America Reimagined receives financial support from the Idaho Falls law firm of Smith, Wolf, Anderson, and Wilkinson. Tonight on America Reimagined, part one of a two-part interview with Gina Bennett on the role of women in national security.
Welcome, everyone, to the Alturas Institute's presentation of America Reimagined, our radio show that invites experts from across the country to consider what America might look like under different circumstances, policies, and programs. The Alturas Institute is an educational nonprofit organization dedicated to defending American democracy by advancing the Constitution, civic education, gender equality, and equal protection of the law. Our guest tonight is Gina Bennett, a veteran of the CIA, a senior analyst in the agency's counterterrorism unit, who is a household name for many Americans, the author of three books, a featured participant in a number of documentaries aired on Showtime, HBO, PBS, the subject of a Newsweek magazine, the subject of a New York Times column, and a number of other outlets. And it's a great pleasure tonight to invite Gina Bennett to join us to share with us her considerable insights into a topic that we're going to explore not only tonight, but next week as well. And that is the role of women in the world of national security. Gina, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, thank you for having me.
If I took all the time that your resume deserves, we would consume two programs. So I simply want to urge our audience tonight to take a look at your book, National Security Mom, National Security Mom 2, to take a look at the Showtime documentary, Spy Masters, and also Manhunters on HBO, and to simply Google Gina Bennett to better understand her many accomplishments in this world, which is not well known to most Americans. And Gina, tonight I want to begin to cover some of your incredible history working in the federal government by noting that shortly after you graduated from the University of Virginia, you took a position at the U.S. State Department where you were working as a secretary. That was your initial job. And how did you come to land that position? And what was it like to work as a secretary in the State Department back in the early 90s, Gina?
Sure, no, thank you. Actually, it was in the 1980s. I started working for Ronald Reagan's presidency. So that alone, for those folks who remember the 1980s, is probably the beginning of the motivation for taking the job. You know, at the time we were dealing with a recession, and when I graduated from the University of Virginia, I had one thing in mind, which is probably similar to a lot of young people today who graduate, and that is go get a job. I didn't want to really go back home and, you know, live at home after having gone to college. So I was gung-ho on taking the first job that I could in the federal government so I could get my foot in the door. And my father had always taught me this: you have to work hard and prove yourself, that no one is going to believe you're smart just because they see a piece of paper that says you're smart. You're going to have to prove to them that you are. So I took that to heart. I was very interested in foreign policy. I wasn't exactly interested in the life of a foreign service officer and taking the foreign service exam and living overseas, only because my father was in the Navy, and my older siblings had always told me it was just horrible traveling around the world. That was kind of my first mistake, was listening to them, but nonetheless. So the position was, you know, it was basically a paid internship. I was a clerk typist for a few months. I started off as GS-4 is the general schedule number. It was, I think I made $12,500 a year, and that was my salary. But, you know, the point was I was out on my own. I got to live on my own, and, you know, working in the Department of State under Secretary Shultz. And just, you know, getting that experience at 21 was amazing. And I, you know, I could still alphabetize and type very, very quickly. So those are skills that, believe it or not, you use for the rest of your life. And, you know, that was my first experience in the government. And I appreciated that I had that opportunity to meet and work with folks who, you know, who often go so unappreciated, the people who make the administration work. You know, they do all of the tasks that help people get their annuities, get their payroll, you know, all of these things that we take for granted, I think, once you move out into other directions. So yeah, that was my first experience.
You know, Gina, you, as I think about the rise of your career, you were working in the federal government when the Berlin Wall came down. You were at the center of so much action in your early years. And for all the value of those terrific clerical skills, which have served you very well in writing thousands of memos and writing three books, it occurs to me that the point to really start delving into your incredible career would have been in 1993, when you became the first analyst to warn of the menace of Osama bin Laden. Can you share that with us, your insights, and what brought you to recognize that bin Laden was indeed a terrible menace to the United States and to the world?
Sure. You know, a lot of it is what we call happenstance. You know, I didn't necessarily deliberately plan for my career to unfold the way it did. But after I had that job for a little while doing the clerical work, I was able to then get a position as a terrorism watch officer. So not like 24 and the TV versions of the watch offices, but, you know, still monitoring the world around the clock every day, 365 days a year. And my role was to monitor terrorist activity. So that, you know, gave me, again, very young, coming into it at the end of the Cold War, when we were still tracking leftist Marxist terrorist groups all over the world, and beginning to learn what the terrorism landscape is and, you know, how we do counterterrorism, it was wonderful because I knew nothing, you know, I was a blank slate. And so just learning it from the very beginning and inheriting the wisdom of folks who had been working through the 60s and the 70s and into the 80s of that type of terrorism, when the Afghan war in 1989 started to wind down because the Soviet Union withdrew, I just happened to be monitoring this experience of people who had volunteered there and were leaving. And it was pretty clear that there were groups of people, and some were more inspirational leaders than others, leaving Afghanistan and saying, you know, hey, we were able to throw the Soviet Union out, and then the Soviet Union fell, and this is all because we put our fundamentalist, you know, very extremist version of Islam first and managed to do this. And one of those individuals happened to be Osama bin Laden. Now, at the time, we didn't know him by that name, but that became clear over the course of a few years who it was. And it was just, again, when you're a blank slate and you're absorbing new information and new patterns, it's all, you know, obvious to you at that time. And so when we started seeing that, it was very different against the backdrop of the Cold War kind of terrorism. So, you know, for me, it was a little bit of an accident, you know, just being in the, maybe you would say the right place at the right time. Some people might say the wrong place, but observing that, being responsible for tracking it and noting that this was something very different from what we had experienced in terms of the terrorism that was much more reflective of left-wing, you know, nationalist, separatist types of terrorist movements. So that's really how I came upon it. And, you know, obviously it wasn't, by 1990, even in 1993, there were not that many people in government who appreciated the potential severity of what we were seeing. It was new. It's hard. It's hard when something is new. You can't possibly know for sure. So when you're predicting the future, it's very difficult to persuade people of exactly how it's going to unfold. So that was one of the challenges. You know,
so you provided a profound insight, which may not have been fully appreciated at the time. Scholars, media figures, and others would later look at your analysis and call it a product of prophetic genius. And people realize that you identified a menace years before he became known to America. What was the initial reaction to your paper, to your report at that point when you identified bin Laden? Because you'd been working only a few years, and as you yourself pointed out, so many colleagues in your area were still focused on the former Soviet Union and Marxist radicals and so forth around the world. What was the reaction to your work at that point?
Yeah, there was a lot of skepticism, and you know, it's understandable, right? We had just come out of the Cold War. We had seemed to have escaped mutually assured destruction through nuclear, you know, Holocaust, and so it was hard for people to wrap their brain around the idea of this individual who has been rejected by his own government. You know, by then the Saudis had pulled his citizenship and was adrift, you know, living in different places, could possibly turn into a threat that would pose a danger to the United States and especially the homeland, right? So that was just hard to believe. So I have always liked the use of analogies to help people understand something that is unfamiliar to them. So you give them something that is familiar. And in the early 1990s, Donald Trump was in fact this up and coming real estate mogul. You know, he was a visionary. He was doing some things that were very different, particularly I remember in, you know, New Jersey. And so I compared Donald Trump and Osama bin Laden. And, you know, I said, look, Osama bin Laden is like Donald Trump. He's got this vision. He has charisma. He has the wherewithal, the commitment. He's going to see it through. He doesn't care whether we believe it or not. And, you know, to try to help people understand, like, an independent actor out there in the world without the benefit of a state to sponsor him, you know, because Osama bin Laden didn't have a state sponsoring him. And even with that, I think most people still thought that was a little far-fetched.
So Jeannie, in those years in the 90s, you're continuing to work in the trenches. You're closely involved in the efforts to protect America against terrorist activities. You're working in the area of counterterrorism. As you move up to that horrific day on 9/11, what do you remember about that day? And once the planes became utilized as weapons, were you among those who were evacuated, or was your unit asked to stay at the wheel, so to speak?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, 9/11 is sometimes a blur and sometimes very clear. I mean, on the one hand, 9/11 was 2.5 years, which I can explain later.
The addition of your family pet is a sign that we're very real on this show. So,
yes, my dog got very upset about all this. But, you know, so at any rate, the day was in many ways, it's definitely a long one, but also somewhat of a blur. But what some of the things I do remember, I mean, I was pregnant on 9/11, so I remember spending a fair amount of time in the bathroom throwing up, which is something that you do when you're pregnant in the early weeks. And I remember being in there at one point with a colleague of mine who was going to have to go upstairs and talk to the director of CIA, George Tenet, at the time. And I, you know, I confided into her why I was sick. And she's like, well, I'm just going to the bathroom because in case we get, you know, under a pile of rubble, I don't want to have to go to the bathroom. So that's literally how we were thinking that particular day. But when the second plane hit, it was very clear to all of us. There wasn't a person in CTC who didn't know what was happening. I mean, we knew that there had been a top-down plot, you know, from Afghanistan, from Al-Qaeda, and it was just very clear to us that that was part of it. We did not think it was ending on that particular day. Like most America look back and you see 9/11 as one day, but for us, we just thought this was the opening part of a longer series of attacks, because they had a lot of other attacks in train, and certainly in their planning stages, if, you know, if not later stages. But as the day went on, we heard rumors of various parts of the building and the government being evacuated. We weren't going to leave. You couldn't have made us leave, but we were also asked to stay. The Counterterror Center was asked to stay so that we could continue to do our work, which was frankly a relief. But because we couldn't figure out how we were going to do our work if we weren't in the building to do it, right? I do recall a number of colleagues from around the building. I mean, like a lot of people just streaming down to the Counterterror Center to offer their assistance. We didn't really have space or specific things for them to do, but it just goes to show you that, you know, I work with the most incredible people, that they're willing to just stay there and help in a situation where, you know, we all thought every federal building was potentially in danger.
Quite a day that lasted for a very long time in your life. Here, I want to digress because you mentioned you were pregnant. And one of the most amazing things about your career, it seems to me, is that as a mother of five, you were pregnant during national security crises throughout your career. And you can certainly match up a number of your pregnancies with some pretty key moments in American history. Would you take us through the births or the pregnancies when these crises broke out and how you kept working, please?
Sure. It's pretty bad when people, you know, in the senior leadership think that you should no longer have any more children because terrorist events keep happening when you do. So, I didn't plan it that way, of course, but my first son was born 3 days before the first attack on the World Trade Center by Ramzi Youssef, who, as most people know, is the nephew of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the mastermind of 9/11. So I was in the hospital when that attack occurred, and I had had a C-section, so it was, you know, surgery. I was still not comfortable at all. And my phone was ringing and I answered my phone and my boss was screaming at me saying, your people did this. This is, you know, you watch TV, whatever, get on them. And when I realized what was going on, I understood what she meant, because we had been tracking these individuals who had left Afghanistan, who were motivated by Osama bin Laden, who were interested in this kind of, these kinds of attacks. So within, I don't know if it was the same day or the next day, I had somebody in my hospital room with a locked bag, you know, and I was dictating my thoughts, my analysis on what had happened. So I had a few days off. And then my second son was born just after the Khobar Towers attack in 1996. So again, a kind of a blur, those two things together. My third child was born just before the Africa Embassy bombings in 1998. So when I went into the building, you know, work with her, she was only a couple of weeks old and I was still nursing her. So I had to bring her with me, and she came in, and I remember at one point I had her on my lap and I was, you know, kind of doing the mother, like moving her around, trying to get her to fall asleep. And I was typing up stuff, you know, for the field. And my boss came around and grabbed her and he's like, give me that baby. And he took her away and she was gone for a couple of hours. And I thought, wow, that kid's going to be hungry when she gets back. So when she got back, you know, I had no idea where she'd been. And later on, I found out that she had been in a meeting and had learned that there was going to be the raid on Al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan a few weeks later. And I continued to tease my boss for years that he had predisposed my daughter to keeping secrets from me because she never told me that she knew of this, right? So she is a very good secret keeper, I will say. My fourth child, of course, I was pregnant on 9/11 with him. And so that was again, 9/11 lasted for a really long time. So that was a tough pregnancy. I did end up in the hospital once because I was just working so much. I was forgetting to eat and drink, you know, and I just, you know, was having some issues with him. So luckily everything worked out and my colleagues were great. They made sure I hydrated and stayed healthy until he was born. And then, you know, my fifth child, really, she was all about Fallujah in Iraq. That was a really rough time. I mean, we had so many horrible attacks occurring inside Iraq. And I, you know, by five kids, you kind of have the whole thing down, right? You know how long you're in labor, you know what to expect. I'm not gonna say it's boring, but it's pretty predictable at this point. So while I was in labor with her, I was briefing Condoleezza Rice, who was the national security advisor at the time. Mm-hmm. She had come over for a briefing and I was part of that team. And so I just sort of, every 20 minutes, I would kind of look the other way and do my breathing and then come back to the conversation. So yeah, I didn't have her that day even. I had her the next day, so it was all good.
What a moment. While you're in labor, you're briefing the national security advisor. That's quite a moment. Yeah, and so
I don't think you really think about it. You just kind of do, you know?
That's called staying on the job. I think you're putting in your dues for sure. So all of this accumulated experience, which we're just racing past, is contributing to your rising position within the agency and will certainly influence your thinking about the role of women in national security. And that's going to be the centerpiece of our talk next week when we meet again. But before we get to that, Gina, you're more than a workaholic because you are writing books, you're appearing in documentaries, you're the subject of an incredible column written by Maureen Dowd of the New York Times, whom our listeners read faithfully. What led you to decide that you wanted to write your first book, National Security Mom? And what a great title, by the way. What was the origin of that title?
Sure. Actually, what happened was, well, two things. Number one, the 9/11 Commission, when they were, you know, redoing research and Freedom of Information Act requests, they found my original work, which still had my name on it. So those original warnings about Al-Qaeda. So that work and my association with it ended up being declassified and released. So that was well beyond my control. But I'd also, at that time, I was pretty active in the Women's Council and the women's groups inside the agency. And we had an event, it was Women's History Month. And I was asked to be on a panel with some other incredible women about work-life balance, you know, the, you know, obvious topic for women, especially at that time, working parents. And I decided, instead of talking about work-life balance, which conjures up this idea that what you do at home and what you do at work are different, that I went with a completely different approach and said, you know what, I do the same thing. I do the same thing at work as I do at home. And, you know, at work, I am a part of a massive national security apparatus, this incredible organization that exists in order to keep people secure, to keep America secure. And at home, I am also part of this incredible effort in the side of this family to make sure my children are secure. And I really realized how similar the work is, and not from a safety perspective, but from a security perspective, which I define those two things differently. And that's how National Security Mom was born. I gave my presentation and I was asked later by the, you know, folks there to turn it into an article for a women's magazine. And then from there, it turned into a book. So it just kept on going, really.
You know, Gina, I have to pause and ask, First, can you share with us your distinction between safety and security? But before we get to that, I'm sure a lot of listeners are sitting here thinking to themselves, let's see, we have loved James Bond movies, and we love Zero Dark Thirty, the star of which was really said to be a composite character of a number of very important women who were tracking bin Laden, one of whom was you, or described to be you. And so our first question probably for many is, we're not accustomed to having representatives of the CIA assuming such a large public role. How did you reach this point, and were there hurdles in the way, or were you encouraged, in fact, to participate in all of these public events and agree to be the subject of documentaries and articles and so forth?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. And I know it's a very unusual place to be, and I don't love it, I'll be honest with you. It comes with a lot of security risk for myself and my family, and a lot of responsibility. And I feel the pressure of representation of people that I can't possibly represent because they're all extraordinary. But, you know, really it started again with the 9/11 Commission, you know, and the FOIA requests and just my name being on these reports and, you know, just the inadvertent accident of somebody not striking out my name, you know, I mean, it just happens. So, you know, with that and the history of my role in highlighting Osama bin Laden and the jihadist movement in those early days, having given that speech where I was looking at both of them, you know, home and work together, and being encouraged by the folks at the agency at the time who were in public affairs to help make more accessible the role of an analyst in counterterrorism, which was, you know, really growing field, and particularly the role of a woman and a mother in that field, so that we could encourage more minorities, more women to consider national security, to consider intelligence careers, to consider counterterrorism careers. And, you know, when you ask me to be a part of that, I'm going to say yes every time, because I believe it's such an important mission to have more diversity and certainly more women in national security. So every time I was asked, I would say yes. And then, of course, the problem is once you're out there, you're kind of an easy target, right? Because you're already out there. So it keeps other people safe. You know, my, you know, colleagues who don't want to assume the risk of such a public persona. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's kind of a vicious cycle. I mean, obviously, it you take on a lot of weight of trying to represent so many different people.
Sure. Well, you speak very modestly and very professionally, as always. And I want to say that our time together in this program has come to an end. But the good news is, for listeners of America Reimagined, you're going to be joining us again next week as we continue our discussion with Gina Bennett, senior analyst with the counterterrorism unit at the CIA, for a probing discussion about the role of women in national security. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Gina, you've been very gracious to join us. Thank you.
Oh, no, thank you for having me. I look forward to our continued discussions.
My pleasure. Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, please sit back and enjoy this beautiful arrangement of America the Beautiful. And you will enjoy the musical talents of our friend Steve Eaton in this song performed by Idaho State Senator Cherie Buckner Webb and 8-year-old phenom Laval. Thank you so much for joining us. Good night.
Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountains, majesty
Find past episodes of this program at kisu.org. Click on Programs and America Reimagined. We hope you join us again next week for the program on Wednesday at 7:30 p.m. This is KISU, Pocatello, Idaho Falls, Rexburg.